You're listening to a fundraising edition of South Florida Arts Beat here on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. Hello, Ed Bell with you. Today on the program, we welcome back 60s pop art icon Peter Max. He'll be signing autographs tomorrow at his two local exhibitions in Fort Lauderdale and Boca Raton. Here's our contributor, Judith Bishop, to tell us more.
Some things are iconic. A Chanel suit, a red Ferrari, and the artwork of Peter Max. Paintings, graphics, and decorative objects that are bursting with color and whimsy. When pop art first exploded, Peter Max was in the forefront of the 20th century movement that paralleled all the cultural, social, and political explosions of the 1960s. From the Beatles to Woodstock to Vietnam, Peter Max captured the zeitgeist. Peter Max got his start at the Art Student League in New York City, where he painted alongside other struggling artists who became modern giants, Andy Warhol, Robert Rauschenberg, and Jackson Pollock. He's painted the last six presidents, and his work appears in presidential libraries as well as U.S. embassies around the world. Among his credits, Max has been the official artist of five NFL Super Bowls, the 2006 Olympics, the World Cup, the World Series, the U.S. Open, Indy 500, New York City Marathon, and the Kentucky Derby. Impressive lists. At age 76, Peter Max shows no signs of slowing down. He has a new book, The Universe of Peter Max, and he has two major shows opening right here in South Florida tomorrow, Saturday, December 14th. One show is at the Wentworth Gallery on Las Olas in Fort Lauderdale. It runs from 1 to 3. There'll be an opening reception with the artist. And the second appearance tomorrow is in Boca at the Wentworth Gallery at the Boca Town Center, that one from 6 to 9 p.m. Peter Max is our guest today on South Florida Arts Beat. He comes to us from his studio in New York City. Peter Max, welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat. It's a pleasure always to have you joining us. And there is so much to talk about, but I'm going to be logical. Let's start at the very beginning. You were born in Berlin to a Jewish family in the year 1937, very ominous times. And soon after your arrival, your parents left Germany. What, if anything, did they tell you about their decision to leave, and how much of an imminent threat were they under when they did depart?
They probably were under all kinds of, difficulties. But, once we got to China and I was just a few months old, maybe 6-7 months old, and I lived there for 10 years, the whole idea of Germany and everything was just completely forgotten. Nobody remembered it. Nobody talked about it much. I mean, I would hear it once in a while, but I was so busy playing with my new Chinese friends. I'm 4 years old, 5 years old, 6 years old. They had all the games worked out. They had multicolored chalks, and we lived in a big lane, and then my father got a big pagoda house, and it was a big area outside that, and it was all a gigantic cement floor between our building and our park, my own park, and then the city park, which was connected. And in that big area, which was a big cement floor, me and maybe 2-3 of my European friends and maybe 25 of my Chinese friends, they would always come with hundreds of beautiful multicolored chalks, and we would draw on the floor. We did that for 10 years, every day. And I don't know, people came and they washed it, they hosed it off, I don't know what, but the floor was always fresh to draw on every day.
That's interesting to me. Does that give you an affinity for street artists? Or graffiti artists?
I have an affinity for all artists, and to tell you the truth, an affinity for all people. I'm a yogi. I studied yoga with one of the great. Remember when the Maharishi came out?
Yes, I do.
The Beatles?
Yes.
Well, 2 years before the Maharishi came, I brought Swami Satchidananda to America, and I opened up a few dozen yoga centers for him. And it was selfish for me, to have it. And I brought all my friends down, and we had yoga centers. And about 2 years after that, I got a phone call from my buddy, Paul McCartney, who I was with about 2 months ago. He spent a whole day with me here in my studio in New York. And he called me up. He says, "Hey, Peter, me and George, and really with the four of us, we just got ourselves a Swami of our own." And I said, "Really? Yeah, his name is Maharishi." Can you imagine?
Absolutely. I remember those times well. Do you belong to a definable sect within
what?
a definable religion or sect within the Eastern spiritual realm?
I studied with Swami Satchidananda. He passed away 10 years ago. He was 90. And I have hundreds of yogi friends. And I do yoga every day. Every day of my life I do yoga. And while I'm talking to you, what I did an hour before and I will do the next 5-10 hours, I'm always what's called in the breath. I always forget, and then you pull yourself back, you always stay in the breath. So sometimes I do it all day long. Sometimes if I forget I'm supposed to be in the breath, I'm right back in it. Sloth, which means that you're just aware of the in and out of the breath with a certain kind of meditative state of mind, you know?
Does this carry over? Do you have a belief in a God? And if so, is it a conventional God or more of a life force?
You know, God is it's a tremendous subject. It's a tremendous entity, and it's universal. You can see God in a flower, in a butterfly, or you could see God in the universe, you know, the whole thing. It's omnipresent, and you can redefine it over and over again. He lives, he or she, right? The God lives in our heart. In yoga, they call it the fourth chakra. But it's the heart region.
To some degree, God lives in your canvases. You have the rainbows.
That's correct.
You have the stars. And there's a story behind that over and above the spiritual aspects. When you were a child, you wanted to be an astronomer, correct?
That's correct. I was so interested in astronomy, and how it really happened was I had a nanny, and believe it or not, when I was 3 years old, my parents found on the street corner about half a block away from where we lived, we had our own fairly large pagoda house, and there was a street artist, and my mother walked up to him one day and said, "Would you teach my son how to draw?" Because from the age of one, I guess, or whenever, you know, as young as I was, my father used to draw with me always. He used to love to draw. And she knew that I loved it a lot. So once my mother saw the street artist, she asked him if he could come to the house. And he says, no, he can't. He has to stay on the street corner where he had like a little can. People would put it in a quarter and whatever that was equivalent. And he would give him a little drawing. But one day, a day or two later, a young girl came to the house, and she was this man's daughter. And she came with pads and paper and pens or pencils. And my mother knew that she was going to come, and my mother hired her. I found out years later, when I was 3, she was 7. Can you imagine that?
More like a sister than a mother
figure.
Yeah,
like a 7-year-old little girl.
Wow.
That earned a living from my mom and, you know, from us, and I fell in love with her. I loved her. By the time I was 4 and 5, she was my best little friend, and I drew with her every day, 7 days a week. And then when we left China, after we went to Tibet for a couple of months, then we came back, and I was with her again for about a month, and then we went on the ship to go to Europe and to Israel. And I remember when the boat pulled away from Shanghai, I started looking over and seeing the horizon, the city of Shanghai, and I cried and cried for Umba, my sweet little girl who taught me how to paint and draw, and I loved it so much. I missed her and loved her and cried for her, and I also cried for my little kitty cat that we left behind.
Now, that was before the technical age where we could Google someone or Facebook them. Did you lose contact with her permanently at that point?
Completely. And I was just back in Shanghai about it's 2 months ago, 2.5 months ago, and I hired a public relations company to find my little Umba. But how do you find her amongst 2 billion people, you know what I mean? It's hard. And when I left China, she was probably 13 years old, right? 14, and I was maybe 7. I was 10. And now she's probably like 70 years old.
But she's still in your heart.
Around, and if I could pay somebody money in Shanghai to find her for me. What I'm looking for now are photographs of me and her when she was young, and we're going to publish them in newspapers all over China. Maybe she'll show up. I would love it.
Well, if she does, or when she does, we'd like to have you both back. That would be a terrific conversation.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sorry, Peter. We have to take a break, but we'll be back with lots more with Peter Max. So stay with us today on South Florida Arts Beat.
Thank you.
The conversation continues with Peter Max and Judith Bishop here on South Florida Arts Beat in just a moment. But please keep our pledge lines ringing during this fundraising edition. We need to hear from you at this time. Keep those pledge lines ringing while the program is on the air. Welcome back to a fundraising edition of South Florida Arts Beat. Hello, Ed Bell with you here on 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM. Please keep our pledge lines ringing while our program is on the air. Now let's return to the conversation between pop art icon Peter Max and our contributor Judith Bishop.
We're back on South Florida Arts Beat with Peter Max, artist extraordinaire, and he will be here in our area on Saturday the 14th at the Wentworth Gallery in Fort Lauderdale and also at the Wentworth Gallery on Glades Road at the Boca Town Center in Boca Raton. So you have an opportunity to speak with Mr. Max. He has wonderful stories to tell, and we're going to continue, Peter, right now. You were quoted as saying, "I never know what I'm going to put on the canvas. The canvas paints itself. I'm just the middleman." Tell us about the moment and the process of creation from your perspective.
Well, what it is for me is I'm always in the mood to be creative, whether I'm walking in the street, whether I'm on an airplane, whether I'm in a taxi, whether I'm, you know, watching TV or I'm in my studio just hanging out, always in the mood to be creative. So the second I walk near my painting room, I got a painting room here in the studio. I've got a big painting area in where I live on Riverside, in Manhattan on Riverside Drive. And I got all my paints and all my brushes and all my canvas. Everything is there. If I feel like painting, boom, I lift up the cover, and suddenly exposed are 77 colors. Seven rows of 11 colors in jars. And I just, you know, put some music on, and I am in the mood.
Well, you are calling from your studio on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and you took some time out from being in the moment to being on the radio with us today.
Yes, it's really fun for me.
Your work has been called Favus in its use of colors, and it's also been called pop art. How do you describe it?
Well, it's hard. You know, there are these different schools of art, and some people see me as a Favus, some as a modernist, some as an impressionist. I think of myself something as any of those, or I like also like abstraction. Abstraction is sort of composition, you know, how you break up the canvas. So I'm always in some...
And
mood, yeah.
Your work and your style in the 1960s were, in a good sense, a perfect storm, in the sense that the world was changing. And were you leading the change? Were you following the trends? How did that work?
Usually when you have a thing going on in the country, in this case it was like the youth market, the youth culture, it was the 60s, it was Woodstock, it was all of this. And I was in that space, in that mood, in that... you know, that time section, and I was painting, and then whatever was out there was also in here, in my heart, and I was expressing it, and it was really great, and it's still there.
You studied at the Art Student League, the Pratt Institute, and the School of Visual Arts with other struggling young artists who also became icons. So what are some of your memories? Who were your contemporaries back then?
Well, there were many. One of them who became a buddy of mine was Andy Warhol. And we used to talk about, you know, what it's like and what we're going to paint and so forth. And I got extremely popular. He got extremely popular.
That is certainly, certainly true. And I bet you could tell us a few good stories about the factory.
Well, he had a nice factory, and that was his production studio. I had a little bit of a different kind of studio, but the key was we were contemporaries. We were creating... an enormous effect in the art market, and he became popular. I became popular. It went back and forth, back and forth. And, you know, he always used to say to me, "Peter, you're on so many magazine covers." Because I was, in the first 10, 15 years, on over 1,000 magazine covers. I couldn't believe it.
1,000 magazine covers. That's
yeah,
ridiculous.
And each magazine cover had a story inside from a 30-pager to a 10-pager or a 5-pager. You know, it was unbelievable.
You know, I think it's a conundrum in a way. We value as a society creativity, and you look at the kids in Silicon Valley, and they're commercial, and they're creative, and they're billionaires by the time they're 27. But somehow, it's okay for a deceased artist to have his work sell for a lot of money. But a living artist being a commercial success is sometimes criticized. I, for one, can't figure that out. What is your take on it?
On what, again?
The idea that commercialism and creativity are accepted in other aspects, in music and in business.
It's in art now, too. You know what it is? We're living in a world that is creative. It's commercial. It's fun to be in. It's where people express themselves, whether it's in color or what they wear or how they live or who they are with and what music do they play. And, you know, there's such abundance. You know, I am such an enormous music lover, you can't imagine. And the other day, you know, a friend of mine was telling me, you know, the layout of all the radio stations. And I said, yeah, there's so many. He says, Peter, there are, in a certain rock and roll, there's like 200 stations. A certain hard rock, it's 600 stations. He says, there's like something like 60,000 stations. I go, my God, I can't even believe that. You know, but that's what it is. And they all live in their own genre, you know what I mean?
They certainly do. Well, let us in on a secret. When Peter Max is home, who do you listen to?
I listen to music. I usually have tapes and CDs, and I have a collection of an enormous amount of music. You know, it used to be where we had records years ago. Then we had CDs. Then we had the little A tracks. Then we had the small tracks, right? And now it's like a little thing you plug in that's the size of a third of a dollar bill, and you stick it into a computer, and you got 10,000 songs on there. It's like mind-boggling.
It is mind-boggling. One of the great things about being home listening to music is if you're doing it with someone you love, that makes it even better. And I know that you are very happily married to a lovely woman named Mary.
Oh, very, very, very happily married.
And I read it was love at first sight. Tell us about that sighting.
Instantly, yeah. It was in 2 seconds I knew I was crossing the street with my friend Chucky. And as I cross over to get some coffee, some decaf, because I don't drink coffee, with my buddy, I go, and as I cross over, there are two women, or two girls, I should say, that ran into each other. And so they stood there talking to each other. And as I stop, get off the sidewalk to go into the street to cross over, I said to Chucky, Chucky, you see this girl? He goes, I'm going to marry her. He goes, Peter, don't do this to me now. Come on, let's go get coffee. I says, no, Chucky, I'm going to marry her. He says, Peter, please don't do this to me now. That's what happened. And after I said the second don't do this to me now, I was already on the other sidewalk across the street. And I introduced myself. She, of course, had never heard of Peter Max, didn't know who I was. But the girlfriend that she met knew who I was. And I gave her my number, and then I left. And I said to me, oh, boy, I hope she calls me. The next day, I'm having brunch with a friend in another cafe, and then my secretary calls up, and she says, you met some girl across from the studio yesterday? She just called, and, oh, my God, yeah, do you have a number? And she gave me the number, and before you knew it, I met up with her for a little decaf somewhere, took her home. Then I met with her again, took her home. And the third time I met with her, we went and had some Chinese food or something, showed her where I lived, and she never left. That's 17 years ago.
Oh, that's a wonderful, wonderful story.
Yeah.
More stories coming up after we take a short break. Peter, we're going to talk to you about your upcoming shows and your fabulous new book and some of the contemporary artists that you have painted.
Thank you.
It's a fundraising edition of South Florida Arts Beat. Hello, Ed Bell with you. Thank you so much for your kind contributions made during the program. They act as a vote of confidence for arts coverage here on 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM. We now rejoin pop art icon Peter Max and contributor Judith Bishop.
We are back on South Florida Arts Beat with artist Peter Max. Peter Max will be in Fort Lauderdale tomorrow at the Wentworth Gallery and also at the Wentworth Gallery in Boca Raton. You can talk to him, meet him in person, and, of course, speak about his art and also speak about his new book called The Universe of Peter Max. Peter, what was the genesis behind the book?
Well, I have a friend who works with me for many years. He's a brilliant guy. And we met one day with a gentleman from the biggest publisher in the world called HarperCollins. And they said to me, and Victor, who works with me, he comes out of a writing background, and he's like an art director, where I'm a painter and artist. And we had a conversation, what kind of book would you do if you did a book? And Victor went on with some ideas, and the next thing I know, they called me back 2 days later, and the publisher wants to meet with us, so we met. They're the biggest publisher in the United States, maybe in the world, called HarperCollins. And the name of the book is called The Universe of Peter Max. It took Victor and I almost a year to put it together, and it's nice. It's a thick book, very inexpensive. I think it's a little bit over $20, maybe 30 at the most or something like that. And it's 285 pages, 50% filled with color, prints, and things. Unbelievable. And it's been out for maybe 10, 15 days now, and I understand they sold already, you know, a huge amount of books, tens of thousands or something like that already in just a few days.
Well, there's so many iconic images in that book. I know that your exhibition's going to feature one of Marilyn Monroe, and I'm also told that there is an interesting story behind that image.
Well, the thing is, I got hold of a gentleman by the name of Joshua Green, who had all these images, and his son, and he was the photographer, Milton Green. Joshua is the boy, and I knew Milton Green very well. I lived in Manhattan in a studio that was right next to Richard Avedon, and I always used to see Joshua Green. So I knew he had all these Marilyn photographs, and we got an exclusive, worldwide exclusive for the next 10 years, and I started painting her and doing images. I just loved it. And the thing that was interesting, many, many years ago, when I was in art school, it's a big school on 57th Street in Manhattan. It's, you know, one of the best avenues in all of Manhattan. And I was sitting on the stoop outside where people enter and leave the school. But we were sitting in a section where people weren't working on the steps, so there were some steps over to the side. And one day I'm sitting there and sipping on some decaf or something, and this gorgeous blonde woman walks by in high heels, click, clack, click, clack, and stunning just the way she walked and everything. And then she looks at us and she goes, "Hey, fellas." And then she remarked about my pants, because I was sitting there with pants and paint all over them, you know, for my art class. "Oh, I love your paint on your pants." And then she kept on walking. And then I said to my friend, "I think that was Marilyn Monroe." She goes, "Yes, I think so." "Oh, my God, she actually spoke to us." I was like maybe 20, 21 years old. And here I am, quite a few years later. I got from Milton Green, from his son, maybe something like 30, 40 photographs of Marilyn. And she is stunning in every photograph. I started painting her. And they're all over the petermax.com. People could see it. They're going to be all over. We're doing so many exhibitions with her. It's a big, big hit, like having a hit movie or something. You know, it's unbelievable.
Oh, I've seen some of those images, and they are stunning and nostalgic and still very, very contemporary.
Yes.
Well, from Hollywood to Washington, you've met a lot of people. You've painted a lot of people, including six presidents. I'm kind of curious, because you strike me as somebody who is politically astute and politically active. How did your politics influence the way you portrayed presidents? Because the last six were certainly all over the map politically.
You know, I painted every president since Carter. I was best friends with Jimmy Carter. Super, super best friends with Ronald Reagan. And unbelievable good friends. We used to speak once a week with Bill Clinton. I knew him before he was governor. And, of course, he told me he was going to run. He told me I was the fifth person he told he's going to run for president. I said, "Bill, you're going to make the most amazing, charismatic president." And wasn't he the most charismatic we ever had?
Amazing life you've had. Absolutely amazing. And the way you've been able to integrate your personal connections and your art and your public life are really, really inspirational. You know, we've talked so much about contemporary figures and modern art, but yet your scholarly training led you to interpret and reinterpret the work of Van Gogh, Monet, Renoir. Tell me about that period in your art and how you adapted their styles.
Well, what happened is, you know, when I got so interested in art and I studied art, and you know, when you in the art world, there's really only like, you know, a big handful, but not an extremely big handful. Maybe there's like 10, 20 major pieces, you know. I mean, there's like Picasso, Monet, Chagall, Van Gogh, and Rembrandt, and then that's it. And of course, now in our modern society, we've got another few big names. And so when I was in art school, of course, I picked up on all the great names, all the great painters, all of these guys, Rembrandt, and of course, the modernists. And then Andy Warhol and I, we were good buddies. And I got known quicker than he did. He used to say, Peter, you're so famous. He says, I says, Andy, you're getting there. You're like 2 seconds behind me. And then, of course, after he died, he went through the roof. You know what I mean? That's what happens when people pass on. They just sold a Marilyn that used to sell for like, you know, $20,000, $30,000 for $105
million. $105 million. Yeah, that is amazing. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, as we were just discussing, your scholarly training made you appreciative of the old masters and the contemporary masters, but you don't look back. You look ahead. One of your most recent...
Yes, I always do.
One of your most recent subjects is Taylor Swift, who's certainly of the moment.
Taylor Swift has become a good, good friend because it turns out she's attractive to paint. She loves my painting, so we were talking on the phone, and I did a whole series on Taylor. She's a sweet girl.
Well, staying current and always evolving is now becoming one of your trademarks, and that's certainly evident in your new book, The Universe of Peter Max. Is there a secret, is there a formula in being, as Bob Dylan said, forever young?
You know, as long as you're creative all the time, and I can't stop being creative, I just love it. I always feel like I'm in my 20s and 30s. That's how I feel.
Great advice and a great note to end on. Well, we wish you continued success. We thank you for joining us today on South Florida Arts Beat.
I hope you both come to my art show when I'm there.
Looking forward to it for sure.
Okay.
Yes, indeed.
All the best.
Thank you, Peter.
Bye-bye.
Judith Bishop is a television journalist who has covered breaking news, politics, and the arts for WABC, CNBC, and WNET. Please stay with us. South Florida Arts Beat will return in just a moment. Thank you so much for your kind contributions made during the show. We greatly appreciate your generosity, but please keep those pledge lines ringing. We'll rebroadcast South Florida Arts Beat tonight and every Friday night at 7 o'clock on our WLRN Extra HD channel. You can tune in on your HD radio or go to our website at WLRN.org for more information. That's a fundraising edition of South Florida Arts Beat. We hope you enjoyed the show. I'm Ed Bell, producer and host. Our theme was composed by Mike Levine and performed by Mike and Sam Levine. Paul Leary is our online producer. Special thanks to our technical director today, Andy Wagner. We'd also like to thank our great contributor, Judith Bishop. Please call us with your comments, 305-995-2258. You can fax us at 305-995-2221 or email us your event information to info@WLRN.org. We'd like to hear from you. Monday at this time, we'll feature topical currents with hosts Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. Monday at 1 o'clock. Have yourself a great weekend, and please keep those pledge lines ringing and your dial set right here to 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM. Until next time, this is Ed Bell saying bye-bye. Enjoy.